Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Well, thank you all for coming this evening. What a happy day it is when we can welcome Frank McCourt. Frank has been here for each of his previous books. First, Angela's Ashes. He was here 2 days before it was announced he won the Pulitzer Prize, and so we were very excited. How many were here that evening? Is there? Yeah, that was a great evening. And Tiz. Yes. Of course, you all know the story of Angela's Ashes, the story, as he gleefully says, of his miserable childhood. Then Tiz continued his story as he made his way to New York City, was told with the same self-effacing humor as his first book. Now the story continues as he begins his career as a teacher. I can happily say he's done it again. Charmed us all with a tale in which he tells of his failures more than his successes, the bad times as well as the good, as he journeys through the New York City public school system. Here you will meet school administrators who try to tame his creative impulses, and students who drive him mad as he tries to impart some precious knowledge to them. Above all, however, it is a tribute to teachers and should be read by all teachers and those who employ them. As a matter of fact, it was suggested by Publishers Weekly and in other reviews that it ought to be required reading for any teacher and also for the politicians who act who set the guidelines for them. Please join me in welcoming once again a national treasure, no matter whether Ireland or the U.S., teacher man, Frank McCourt.
Thank you. Thank you, Monica. This place is a national treasure. This bookstore. And it should be declared off limits to politicians. Oh no, I take that back. I don't want to be divisive, as they say. But the idea of politicians setting guidelines for teachers makes me laugh. It would be like teachers setting guidelines for politicians. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a Broadway matinee of Eugene O'Neill's play, A Touch of the Poet, in which a pal of mine is appearing, Gabriel Byrne. It's a terrific play, but before it started, my wife Ellen wasn't with me, so I was sitting back in row E by myself, and a woman in the front row got up and she came back, this little skinny little woman, and she leans over and she says to me, "Are you Frank McCourt?" I said, "Yeah." "You wrote that book, Angela's Ashes." I said, "Yeah." "What?" She said, "Not too many people are going to tell you this, but I have to tell you, that book is disgusting. It's despicable." And what are you supposed to do at a moment like that? Do you haul off and punch her? But I didn't, because I noticed her husband was very big. And I'm a real coward. So the other alternative is to laugh. And I started laughing. I think she was offended, because I was supposed to be offended. Well, and so she said, "Oh, to offend me," and I started laughing. And then she said, I am a proud Irish American." Now, what are you supposed to say? Well, congratulations. It's very hard to respond to pride like that, because I suppose I'm Irish-American too, but I don't know if I'm particularly proud of it. I don't know what I am. I happen to be born in New York to Irish parents and taken to Ireland. I grew up there and I came back and I'm back and forth, back and forth. The traveling hyphen, Irish-American. So, and then I read, I was thinking about it later on, but on the way out of the theater that afterwards, because I'd been on television, I'd been seen, various people on the way out of the place said, oh, congratulations, I love your work and all that. And I looked at her and I got some satisfaction out of the deepening bitterness in her miserable old face. So that's mean, isn't it? I should be more charitable. I'm a great student these days of forgiveness, not a serious student of forgiveness. But after that, I was thinking about what she said, and I said, when she said, I'm a proud Irish American, and you hear about this stuff a lot, I'm proud this, I'm proud that, be proud of your heritage. And I started thinking about my heritage, what the hell is it? And then I realized, I wasn't put on this earth to be Irish. The sperm, my father, did say, oh, we're all going to be Irish. Nor was I put on this earth to be American, and I definitely wasn't put on this earth to be Catholic. So, and these, from two of these things, the Irish part and the Catholic part, have given me great material for writing. Great suffering, but great material for writing. If I hadn't grown up Irish Catholic, I probably wouldn't have written anything. Because the one thing about being hyphenated and Irish and Catholic and so on, a lot of suffering comes with it. And a lot of guilt. Irish guilt, Irish Catholic guilt. I have Jewish friends, and they're always going on about Jewish guilt, and they haven't a clue. I know the Jews were driven out of Palestine, Israel, 2,000 years ago, but the English invaded us 800 years ago. They invaded Ireland, and I'd put Irish suffering up against Jewish suffering anyway. So we grew up with this sense, the victim sense, a culture of victimization, you might call it, that when we went to school, which we did till we were 13 or 14, we had to. That's the way the Irish government was. You have to learn how to read and write so that at 16 you can emigrate to England. Not too many of us stayed in Ireland, but we were told about how the English invaded us 800 years ago and how mean they were, which they were. They were very mean to us, and there was genocide and everything else, and they hunted down Catholics, and they banned Catholicism at one time with something called the penal laws. And if you were a Catholic, you couldn't read. You couldn't own a horse worth more than £5, and you couldn't go to school, and you couldn't own land and all of this. And this is what the teachers told us. So they were in imbuing us a sense of the suffering of the English. This did not give us any energy. We'd sit in class, little kids, 10, 11, 12, feeling how much we hated the English. We did. I grew up, I was a little kid growing up during World War II, and we rooted for the Germans. We didn't know anything about Nazis or our concentration camps. Well, nobody knew at that time. We wanted the Germans to win. We dreamed of the German Navy sailing up the River Shannon and all these stormtroopers storming ashore and the give us stone. But that's how we were. That's how we were conditioned or brainwashed or bullied. The other side of the conditioning was Catholicism. It'd be very hard to explain to you who are not Catholic what Catholicism is like, especially Irish Catholicism. There's Italian Catholicism, which I think I would have enjoyed because they don't give a shit about anything. The women go to church and the men sit in the cafes. And the men are eyeing the Italian girls passing by. Sophia Loren goes back and forth, back and forth. And the men are lusting after Sophia. But in Ireland, it was a different story because we grew up in this rigid Puritan society, which was derived from a branch of French Catholicism called Jansenism. They might as well have been in 17th century New England. This was so profound was their distaste for the flesh, for sexuality, for anything like that, any romance. And this, the strange thing about it, the Irish in the Middle Ages and before that were really a very physical race of people. You wouldn't know it in later centuries, but the women in Ireland, for instance, were so free that if a woman got pregnant, she could go out and point to any man and say, "You're the father." And she might have no notion, but if she said, "You're the father," he had to accept responsibility. And sometimes strangers coming to Ireland were greeted by the women. The women would open their cloaks and you saw everything. Was that shocking? So this was their way of greeting people. So it was a very open and free society at one time, and very poetic. The poetry of Ireland going way back was very romantic and sensual and so on. But then it became much grimmer, and there was a strong religious cast to it. But it, as I said, it would be very hard to describe what Catholicism was like. It was not a life-enhancing religion. It was grim. We were told mostly from the age of 4 or 5 when we went to school, we were told that this life is a vale of tears. Don't expect much. It's got to end someday. So you better follow the teachings of the church, because if you die in a state of sin, down you go. Hell. Well, we were little kids, and we found now, when I look back at how powerful the priests were in preaching, describing hell. They were very good at that. A little weak in describing heaven, because heaven was a kind of a bland place. It was always like a Protestant restaurant. It was so... It was a kind of lifeless place where angels flap around, and we were told that the reward for leading a good and virtuous life was that you stood for eternity gazing on God's countenance. That didn't appeal to me. I wanted to be a Muslim and have all kinds of virgins gathering around me. But then they told us about sin. I'm telling you this now because I want to compare it with what comes up later on when I started teaching in New York, which is a different story altogether. Those 16-year-old girls in my classes could have taught me a thing or two. But I'm growing up in Ireland, and they're brainwashing us, and they never, ever encourage curiosity or creativity. I never remember a teacher smiling. I never remember laughter in the classroom. I remember a lot of brutality. I remember the stick with which they beat us around the room. You know, the hand would go out, and they give you, as I say, 6 in each hand if you missed a question in the catechism. The catechism was a book with questions and answers for where you had to prepare for communion, first communion, and then confirmation. You had to memorize all the questions and all the answers, and also the emphasis was on sin. No matter what you did, it was a sin. Especially when it came to the flesh, the body, or looking at girls. That was they'd say, "Well, you weren't going to do anything, but you thought about it." Just think about it. And then they had, if you did it, it was called the sin of commission. And if you didn't know, it was a sin of omission. So whether you did it, they had you. They had you either way. Now, we were small kids, and here we're struggling with all of this. At a very age, you become a theologian because you're trying to figure things out. You're trying to figure out what the teachers are telling you. You're not questioning. You're accepting everything, because not to accept is disbelief, and disbelief leads to the biggest sin of all, which is despair. And despair is giving up hope in God. And if you give up hope in God, you're done, baby. It's all over. So, and we're little kids and we're struggling with this. And I grew up in a constant state of fear and worry, because they told us, and it was all physical, it was all tangible, if you died with a sin on your soul, you went to hell. A sin, the soul was in here someplace. And I think it was white. And a sin was a dark thing, an abscess. If you committed a mortal sin, it started oozing. And it was putrid. And it started dribbling down. And if you died with that thing on your soul, you went to hell. Forever. Forever. Can you imagine a seven-year-old trying to get wrap his mind about around this forever? You suffer forever in this place with walls. Read James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist, and he has a description of hell with walls a million miles thick, and the temperature of hell being a million degrees, and devils running around chasing you with pitchforks. They have nothing else to do but shove these red hot pitchforks up your arse for the sins you've committed. And this is how we grew up. And this is what the teachers participated in. I had, I think, eight teachers. And I never remember any merriment in the class. And there was one teacher towards the end, Mr. O'Halloran, told us, and it was almost the last words I heard in elementary school in Ireland, he told us to leave Ireland. He was the only one who looked at us and addressed us as human beings. Leave Ireland, he said. There's nothing for you here. If we stayed, we'd finish primary school, elementary school, and they'd get jobs as messenger boys or other labouring jobs. If you were lucky, get any kind of a job. Otherwise, you went on the dole, which was unemployment, which at that time was about £1 a week, with which you were supposed to support a family. So most of us, maybe over 60% of the kids in my class, went off to England. And I came to America. That was my dream. And I was able to come to America because I was born here, and there was no problem with getting visas, passports, or anything like that. So this is the condition, the emotional, psychological condition that I was in when I arrived in America. I still believed in Catholicism. I still believed in heaven and hell. I believed in sin. I believed in purgatory. I believed in limbo. They're trying to do away with that now. What's going to happen to all the little babies in limbo? It's a place where little babies go, unbaptized babies. If you have a baby and the baby dies and the baby wasn't baptized, it goes to limbo. What's going to happen when they abolish limbo? Where did the babies go? Heaven, I suppose. Well, limbo isn't such a bad place. I think it's painless, not like hell. So I believed in all of this stuff. When I came to America, I still had a strong sense of sin. But now there's temptation in New York, where I was told by Irish friends of mine, get yourself a Jewish girl. They're wild. Another one would tell me, get yourself a Protestant. They never know when to stop. I was 19, I suppose, and lusty. I wasn't illiterate, but I was ill-educated, never having gone to high school. So I knocked around New York for a while, and I would go to Irish dances on the Upper East Side of New York. And I didn't fit in. These were my own people. But they all seemed to be farmers' daughters. And I was much more sophisticated than that. I came from the streets of Limerick. And you'd see a row of these girls sitting along the wall. And they all seemed to wear some kind of satin, or pink satin or something. And I would ask them, shyly and tentatively and apologetically, would you like to dance? And they invariably they say no. So I was crushed. And once in a while, a very unappealing, unappetizing woman would say yes. And because I was her last chance, so her last hope for a man. And she might dance with me, and I'd step all over her feet. And she'd say, I can't be clumping around here all night. That she'd tell me so. That would crush me. I was constantly being crushed. But I was saved then by the Chinese. Because China invaded Korea. And America got nervous and turned to me. And drafted me into the army. But they didn't send me to Korea. They sent me to Germany, to Bavaria, for 2 years, where you know there was great surplus of beer, and a great shortage of men. So there was plenty of young women around, and they put me into something called the Canine Corps, to train German Shepherd attack dogs, for 2 years, which is very good preparation for my future career of teaching. So I spent my 2 years in Germany, 2 years a vacation at the taxpayers' expense. And I came back and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I didn't feel confident about anything because there was, when you belong to a certain group of people, a certain race, there are expectations. If you were Irish, they expected, I was told by people, join the cops. Get your high school diploma and join the cops. Or you could go into the bar business. These were the two main roles for the young Irish. And I didn't want to fall into the ethnic stereotype. And it wasn't just that. I saw people going to college. I saw young men and women in the suburbs of New York with their book bags and the textbooks that said Columbia and Fordham, CCNY and Rutgers, and I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to know what's that world there where they're learning. But I didn't have the education. I didn't have a high school. I didn't even have a day of high school. So in the meantime, I'm working on the docks and the warehouses and getting desperate because I didn't see any escape for myself. I felt very desperate. I was going to be unloading ships and trucks for the rest of my life. And I knew I was literate enough, so someday maybe somebody told me, you stick with this long enough and you could be a checker. I could have the clipboard checking. Oh, yeah, there's a load, there's five loads, there's five cartons. I could do that, and that'd be called rising in the world. So I didn't know what to do, and I got desperate one day and I went to New York University. I just happened to be in Greenwich Village. And I asked somebody where the admissions office was, and I went in there and I persuaded them that I was intelligent. And I was, to do that, I must have been very desperate. And they believed me. So they admitted me to NYU. And I spent my 4 years there and got my degree. And then I took the test for teacher. My license for teaching English in the New York City High School. I barely passed the test. The passing grade was 65. I got 69. I was just lucky, I think, to get through. And then came the question of getting a job. The movie that came out at that time, concurrently with me getting my license, was called The Blackboard Jungle. And that scared the shit out of me. And then there were people telling me, if you get a job, don't ever go into a vocational high school, they'll kill you. Well, I saw Glenn Ford nearly been driven mad in the Blackboard Jungle, but I couldn't get a job anywhere else, so it was into the vocational high school. And it wasn't my dream. My dream was to teach in some suburban high school that I would teach mainly Episcopalians and because they're a very high class of people, very clean, and so I thought I'd be in one of those lovely suburban high schools with one of those wonderful high schools and nice people all driving up in the convertibles and so forth, and maybe I was contemplating converting to Episcopalianism, so I didn't. That wasn't the job. That was my vision. I wound up in McKee Vocational High School. And that was the beginning of my adventures as a teacher. And I just read to you what my first day was like. If you've ever been a teacher, if you are a teacher, you know what the first day was like. You're in your room and you're waiting for your class to come in. And in my case, I was particularly inept. I'd never been in a high school. I'm in a high school finally to teach in one, but I'd never set foot in one before. And I didn't know anything about American adolescents. Teenagers. We didn't have teenagers in Ireland. You went to school and then you went to work. So there was nothing of this, none of the stuff of being moody in between. I got, I think when I was about 12 or 13, I got a bit moody one day. And my mother said to my grandmother, I don't know what the bloody hell is the matter with him. I can't do a thing with him. And my grandmother said, well, I think he has the growing pains. That's as far as it went in Ireland. He has the growing pains. It was obvious that you were going to grow. She said, my grandmother said, take him over to O'Connor the chemist. That's the local pharmacy. Take him over to O'Connor the chemist for the growing powder. So my mother took me over to O'Connor the chemist for the growing powder. And Mr. O'Connor said, and my mother couldn't afford sixpence for whatever it was. So he comes out and he has a kind of, you know those papers you make cigarettes in, kind of a piece of cigarette paper, and some white stuff in it. And he tells my mother, tell him, put that under his tongue. And I put it under my tongue, and I felt wonderful, ecstatic. I was floating on air. And it was cocaine, I think. I'm sure it was cocaine. And after that, I pretended to have the growing pains all the time. Could I go back to Mr. O'Connor, the chemist? I feel moody. But that. So there was no transition. You just went to school and then you went to work. And that's what I knew of adolescence. Now, here I'm to deal. Here now, on the first day of my teaching career, I'm to face American adolescence. 5 classes a day, 35 in each class. Imagine it, those of you who've never been teachers. Just imagine it. You might have a teenager at home, and you know what that's like. You know for you that it's time on the cross. They make you climb the wall. So this is my first day. A boy named Petey called out, anyone want a bologna sandwich? You kidding? Your mom must hate you giving you sandwiches like that. Petey threw his brown paper sandwich bag at the critic, Andy, and the class cheered. Fight, fight, they said, fight, fight. The bag landed on the floor between the blackboard and Andy's front row desk. I came from behind my desk and made the first sound of my teaching career. After 4 years of higher education at New York University, all I could think of was, hey! They ignored me. They were busy promoting the fight that would kill time and divert me from any lesson I might be planning. I moved toward Petey and made the first teacher statement of my life. Stop throwing sandwiches. That's called classroom management. Petey and the class look startled. This new teacher just stopped a good fight. New teachers are supposed to mind their own business or sent for the principal or a dean, and everyone knows it's years before they come, which means you can have a good fight while waiting. Besides, what are you going to do with a teacher who tells you stop throwing sandwiches when you already threw the sandwich? From the back of the room, Benny called out, hey, teach! He already threw the sandwich. No use telling him, no, don't throw the sandwich. There's the sandwich right there in the floor. The class laughed. There's nothing sillier in the world than a teacher telling you don't do it after you already did it. One boy covered his mouth and said, stupid. And I knew he was referring to me. I wanted to knock him out of his seat, but I knew that would have been the end of my teaching career. Besides, the hand that covered his mouth was huge, and his desk was too small for his body. Someone said, yo, Benny, you a lawyer, man? And the class laughed again. Yeah, yeah, they said, and waited for my move. What will this new teacher do? Professors of education at New York University never lectured on how to handle flying sandwich situations. They talked about the theories and philosophies of education, about moral and ethical imperatives, about the necessity of dealing with the whole child, the gestalt, if you don't mind, the child's felt needs, but never about critical moments in the classroom. Should I say, hey, Petey, get up here and pick up that sandwich? Or should I pick it up myself and throw it into the waste paper basket to show my contempt for people who throw sandwiches while the world starves? They had to recognize that I was boss, that I was tough, that I'd take none of their shit. The sandwich in wax paper lay halfway out of the bag, and the aroma told me there was more to this than bologna. I picked it up and slid it from its wrapping. It was not any ordinary sandwich where meat has slept between slices of tasteless white American bread. This bread was dark and thick, baked by an Italian mother in Brooklyn, bread firm enough to hold slices of a rich bologna, layered with slices of tomato, onions, and peppers, drizzled with olive oil, and charged with a tongue-dazzling relish. I ate the sandwich. That got their attention. Because usually when there are new teachers, they ignore you. They come in and, you know, they thought maybe I was a new substitute teacher, but they stared at me, they gawked. And of course the word went around the school. But it's as if somebody had written a script. At that moment, passing by is the principal. And he looks in, he sees me standing there in front of the class in the morning, and I'm called to his office that afternoon. What's this? What are you doing, eating your lunch at 9 o'clock? No, I wasn't. And I tried to explain to him I wasn't eating my lunch at 9 o'clock in the morning. But he didn't understand. So I was told, he warned me that if this happened again, they'd have to put a letter in my file, which I'll get to in a minute. So what happened was this. I told stories. Anything to keep them quiet and in their seats. They thought I was teaching. I thought I was teaching. I was learning. And you called yourself a teacher? I didn't call myself anything. I was more than a teacher. And less. In the high school classroom, you're a drill sergeant, a rabbi, a shoulder to cry on, a disciplinarian, a singer, a low-level scholar, a clerk, a referee, a clown, a counselor, a dress code enforcer, a conductor, an apologist, a philosopher, a collaborator, a tap dancer, a politician, a therapist, a fool, a traffic cop, a priest, a mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, a bookkeeper, a critic, a psychologist. You're the last straw. These are all the roles you play when you're a teacher. I didn't know that. Most people don't know that about teachers. The thing, you just go in there and you stand there. All right, open your notebooks. Oh, really? You don't even have to tell them that. These good kids. I thought I'd go in there and I'd lecture. I would talk about Shakespeare's history plays or something like that. Or why was Hamlet mean to his mother? We'd analyze that, and they'd write it all down. And they'd look at me admiringly. And they'd go home and tell their parents about what this wonderful new Irish teacher who's so inspiring. And all the parents would invite me to dinner, and I'd never have to buy a dinner again in my life. And that's what I thought it was going to be. No, it wasn't like that. The first day was the day of the sandwich. And the next day, I found out that kids will do anything to keep you away from any lesson you might be planning. Especially in my case, because I didn't know anything. I think they saw that there was something about me. He might be thinking of talking about grammar or something. So, on my second day, a boy asked a question. Joy Santos was his name. And this changed the course of my life. This question, and this one simple incident changed the course of my life. It started me talking about something that I never dreamed I'd talk about, which was my life. You teach. You are not to call out. You are to raise your hand. Yeah, 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 yeah. They have a way of saying yeah, yeah, that tells you they're barely tolerating you. In the yay yay, they're saying, look, we're trying to be patient, man, giving you a break because you're just a new teacher. He raises his hand, Joy. So, yo, teacher man, call me Mr. McCoy. Yeah, 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 yeah. So, you scotch or something? Joy is the mouth. There's one in every class, along with the complainer, the clown, the goody-goody, the beauty queen, the volunteer for everything, the jock, the intellectual, the mama's boy, the mystic, the sissy, the lover, the critic, the jerk, the religious fanatic who sees sin everywhere, the brooding one who sits in the back staring at the desk, the happy one, the saint who finds good in all creatures, and it's the job of the mouth, like Joy, to ask questions. No, Joy, I'm not Scotch, I'm Irish. Well, yeah. So, like, you know, what's Irish? Irish, whatever comes out of Ireland. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like St. Patrick, right? Well, no, not exactly. So this leads to the telling of the story of St. Patrick, which keeps us away from the boring English lesson, which leads to other questions. Hey, mister, everyone talk English over there in Ireland? What kind of sports do you play? You all Catholics in Ireland? Don't. Let them take over the classroom. Stand up to them. Show them who's in charge. Be firm or be dead. Tell them. Open your notebooks. Time for the spelling list. Oh, God, man, teach them. Oh, shit. Oh, God, spelling. Do we have to... These boring spelling lists... They pretend to bang their foreheads on the desk. They bury their faces in their folded arms. They beg for the pals. Gotta go, man. Gotta go. We thought you was a nice guy, young and all. Why do all these English teachers have to do the same old thing? Same old spelling lessons, same old vocabulary lessons, same old shit, excuse the language. Can't you tell us more about Ireland? Your teacher, man. Joy again. Joy, I told you my name is Mr. McCourt. Mr. McCourt. Yeah, 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 sir. So, like, see, no, Mr. Did you go out with girls in Ireland? No, damn it, sheep. We went out with sheep. What do you think we went out with? So the class explodes. They laugh, they clutch their chests, nudge each other, elbow one another, pretend to fall out of their desks. This teacher, crazy man, talks funny, goes out with sheep. Lock up your sheep. So they go home that afternoon, and when the parents always say, so how was school? Well, there's this teacher. He goes out with sheep. And of course, teachers call the school, and I'm called into the principal's office the next day. And well, he said, what's this? What is it? I said, what? You know, this, you know, the you've been in school 2 days, and 2 days you're in the soup. First the sandwich, now the sheep. You're standing in front of that class advocating bestiality. I said, no. I said, it was just, I was frustrated. They were asking me these questions, and I just got frustrated. Well, look, he said, you're asking for it. You keep this up, and there's going to be a letter in your file. I didn't know what that was. I was a... Second day in the job. Letter in your file won't do you any good. Because, he said, if you want to rise up in the school system, this letter could be an impediment to your rising, to your progress. I said, what rising? What? Well, you know, you might want to be an assistant principal. I said, no, I just came here to teach. Oh, well, they all say that. They all say they come here to teach. 6 months from now, you'll be clamoring to get out of here. Before you're 30, your hair will be white. Well, I began to get the drift then that teaching is not the noble profession within the school system, because there's so many people go into it and to get out of it. I discovered in my dim, groping way that many people go in and they spend maybe a year or two and they say, this is not for me, and they take the exam for supervisor and principal and so on, and they get out because the farther you get from the kids, the more you're rewarded. This is peculiar. It would be like a surgeon being paid for not operating. Go upstairs and stay in the penthouse. But in the school system, you're a teacher. That's the lower salary level. You become an assistant principal. Oh, then you move down the hall when you get an office, an assistant, the secretary, and you're on toilet with double-ply toilet paper. And then you got to seminars and conventions. You're sent off to Hawaii for the yearly meeting of assistant principals in biology, or phys ed, or physics, or something like that. But there was no encouragement to stay in the classroom. But I didn't think it's not that I had the integrity that I'm going to stay in the classroom and be a teacher. I didn't think I could ever be an assistant principal, which would mean supervising other teachers. I couldn't do that, or I could certainly never be a principal. And I felt I was beginning to feel comfortable in the classroom with the kids. They were, in a sense, that was where I belonged. That was the level of my maturity. Because I don't think, since I'd never been a teenager in Ireland, this was my last chance to be a teenager. So I suppose that's what kept me in the classroom. But I still had to make my way through the system, and I was learning. I was beginning to question what it was all about, asking myself, what is a school for? What's the purpose of a school? What is education all about? And I knew it wasn't what I came from in Ireland. I knew it wasn't conditioning. I knew it wasn't brutality or brainwashing. And I found, well, we're not so far from that in the school that I was in, because over their heads, we always had the specter, the threat, the menace of the tests. No child left behind. There will be a test, fourth grade, eighth grade, and in between, because we have to have standards. So I was discovering this and resisting it, because I think I had a dream of what education should be, and it was the vision of Socrates sitting under a tree with the young men of Athens talking. Now, I know that's fairly illogical and unrealistic, but I had an idea of a school that would be more flexible, instead of people like assistant principals and principals and so on walking around, peering in the window to make sure the kids were in their seats. That's all they cared about. They didn't ask the kids any questions at the end of the day. Did you learn anything? In my 18 years of Stuyvesant High School, one mother asked me, do you think my Jonathan is enjoying school? One parent. So in the 18 years at Stuyvesant High School, I used to ask graduating seniors, there were 700 seniors every year, how many of you would like to be high school teachers? And in 18 years, two raised their hands. One of them I wouldn't allow to teach dogs. And the other one, I think, was a putative serial killer. And that's all. There was no urge whatsoever to teach, because teaching is not an attractive, as in this country anyway, it's not an attractive profession, because it's underpaid. All teachers will tell you that. And those of you who are not teachers, who are hostile to teachers, would say, well, you get all that time off. Really? All that time off. Let me read you a little piece about what time off was like. And every teacher knows what I'm talking about. The bag on the floor in a corner by the kitchen, never far from sight of mine. That bag was an animal, a dog waiting for attention. Its eyes followed me. I didn't want to hide it in the closet for fear I might forget completely. There were papers in that bag to read and correct. There was no point in trying to read them before dinner. I'd wait till later, help with the dishes, put my daughter to bed, get down to work, get that bag, man, sit on the couch where you can spread things out, put some music on the phonograph or turn on the radio, nothing distracting, some acoustic syrup, music to grade papers by, set yourself on the couch, rest your head a minute before you tackle the first paper on your lap. The title of the paper is My Stepfather the Jerk. More teen angst. Close your eyes a moment. Ah, drift, teacher, drift. You're floating. A slight snore wakes you. Papers on the floor. Back to work. Scan the paper. Well written. Focus. Organized. Bitter. Oh, the things this girl says about her stepfather. That he's a bit too familiar with her. Invites her to movies and dinner when her mother works overtime. And there's the way he looks at her. Mother says, oh, that's nice. But there's something about her eyes. And then the silence. Writer wonders what she should do. Is she asking me, the teacher? And should I do something? Am I to respond, help her out of her dilemma? If there is a dilemma, stick my nose into family matters where it doesn't belong. She could be making it up. What if I say something and it gets back to stepfather or mother? I could read and evaluate this paper objectively, congratulate the writer on the clarity and development of her theme. That's what I'm there for, isn't it? I'm not supposed to get involved in every little family squabble, especially in Stuyvesant High School, where they like to let it all hang out. Teachers tell me half these kids are in therapy and the other half should join them. I'm not a social worker or a therapist. Is this a cry for help or another teenage fantasy? No, too many problems in these classes. Kids in other schools were never like this. They didn't turn the class into group therapy. Stuyvesant is different. I could give this paper to a guidance counselor. Here, Sam, you take care of this. If I didn't, and it came out later, the stepfather abused the girl, and the world knew I'd let it slip by. Important people in the school system would summon me to their offices, assistant principals, superintendents. They'd want explanations. How could you, experienced teacher, let this happen? My name might even blaze across page 3 of the tabloids. Make a few marks with the red pen. Give her a 98. The writing is terrific, but there are spelling errors. Congratulate her on writing a paper that is honest and mature. And tell her, Janice, you have great promise, and I hope to see more of your work in the coming weeks. They have ideas I want to dissipate about the private lives of teachers. I tell them, in your head, choose one of your teachers. Don't tell anyone the name. Don't write it down. Now speculate. When that teacher leaves the school every day, what does he or she do? Where does he go? You know, after school, every teacher goes directly home, carries a bag filled with papers to be read and marked, might have a cup of tea with the spouse. Oh no, teachers would never have a glass of wine. That's not how teachers live. They don't go out. Maybe a movie on the weekend. They have dinner. They put their kids to bed. They watch the news before they settle in for the night to read those papers. At 11, it's time for another cup of tea or a glass of warm milk to help them sleep. Then they put on pajamas, kiss the spouse, and drift off. Teachers' pajamas are always cotton. Well, what would a teacher be doing in silk pajamas? And no, they never sleep naked. If you suggested nudity, students look shocked. Man, can you imagine some teachers in the school naked? This always triggers a big laugh, and I wonder if they're sitting there imagining me naked. And what is the last thing a teacher thinks about before sleeping? Before they drift off, all those teachers, snug and warm in their cotton pajamas, think only of what they might teach tomorrow. Teachers are good, proper, professional, conscientious, and they'd never throw a leg over the other one in the bed. Below the belly button for teachers is dead. So this is what I was learning about what teachers are like. This is the model of the teacher. So I was learning, and I felt myself, I'm almost professionally a second-class citizen, because we always talked about pay raises, more money, and smaller classes, but then society would always say, well, you get all that time off and so on. So all that time off. If you were to take 175 students, give them an essay of 300 words, multiply 300 by 175, and there goes your weekend. Weekend after weekend after weekend, that was it. They always talk about teachers' short teaching days, but you can never get out from under it. And then the unions and the teachers' associations try to convince you of certain things about the noble work we're doing. But the ads they put on television elsewhere are always teachers being goody-goody, leaning over students in their very concerned way. When they should use one word in connection with teaching. And if they did, I think young people would swarm into the profession. Teaching is sexy. Yeah. But that's a dangerous. So I made my way. These are the things I was discovering about the nature of the teaching profession, how it laps over into your life. You never get out from under it. But they say, well, you have all the summers off. Oh yeah. well, with this pay you get, you have to work every summer, or you have to take courses to rise up to the next salary level. If it's such an easy life, I don't know why people are not swarming into it. Why is it that in New York City, 50% of the new teachers drop out before the end of the third year? That's a simple statistic. If it's that attractive, if it's that easy, if you have all that time off, young people would be swarming into it, but they know otherwise. In any case, I stayed in the profession. And the longer I stayed in, the more I enjoyed it, even though it was more challenging all the time. The challenge in some cases, was, for me anyway, was to overcome the resistance to grammar, which I knew nothing about. I had to overcome my own resistance to it. And poetry. If you mention poetry to high school kids, they groan. Because all they hear is English teachers seeking for the deeper meaning of the poem. And I had to tell my students, and this is another thing I learned, the value of honesty. I had to tell them most of the time I didn't understand the damn poem myself. But what does it matter? Let's all recite it together. And we recite it together. What does it matter? If you say it often enough, this, if meaning is that important, meaning will come to you. Some of Shakespeare's sonnets are very difficult to understand, but say them often enough, it's like developing a relationship. Does any man know the woman he's living with? She's a poem. If there's a deeper meaning there, maybe it'll come out in 50 years. I don't think they understood what I was talking about when I said a poem is like I like your husband or like your wife. You never get to know this person, so live with it for a while. And also, don't worry, there will be no test. That's what used to drive me crazy. We might be having a hot discussion in the class. We're in the middle of something. The whole class is rapt, attentive, and a hand goes up. Yes, Michael. Could I have the PS? And a kid like that got very close to be strangled because they ruined the flow of a lesson. These are the moments in the classroom, but you have your moments of pure ecstasy, and anyone who's ever done it, who's ever taught, will know what I'm talking about. Moments when everything comes together. You might be talking about a poem or a short story or something, and everybody at the same time has that understanding. That was my experience. It went on for 30 years, and in the end, I retired. They gave me a lunch. Teachers get the lunch. Principals get the dinner. And I went home and I thought about my career, and I was very satisfied, sincerely satisfied, that's how I spent my life. And I was glad I did it, and I hoped I was useful. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.